Hey, friends, and welcome to season 3 of A Meaningful Mess podcast. I'm so honored that you decided to listen, and I hope that you enjoy what you hear. I'm your host, Andy McNair, and I'm a wife, mom, blogger, author, and passionate educator that believes in today's learners. I'm so glad that you found the podcast, and I can't wait to share manageable and meaningful ideas for you to utilize in your classroom and beyond. My hope is that the ideas and strategies shared each week will help you find meaning in your mess. After you listen, please feel free to subscribe, rate, and share the podcast with anyone that you think might find it helpful. You can also connect with me over on my website at andymcnair.com, on Twitter at McNairAN3, and on Facebook and Instagram at A Meaningful Mess. Thanks for being here today. Let's get started. Welcome back to A Meaningful Mess podcast. Today's episode is a little bit different in that it's a little bit longer because it's the recording of a conversation I recently had with a special guest over on my Facebook page and YouTube channel regarding project-based learning. Every once in a while, I'll share free webinars and content in this way. Throughout season 3 of the podcast, I plan to share my conversations with special guests once each month. If you want to catch these live, you can always find what's coming up over at andymcnair.com/learning. Okay, back to today's episode. In this episode, I had the privilege of speaking with and learning from Will Rodriguez. Will is a teacher at Manor New Tech and has lots of experience with PBL. Throughout the conversation, he shares the benefits of project-based learning, advice on how to manage this type of learning, and how powerful it is when we put our learners in the driver's seat. I absolutely cannot wait for you to hear all that he has to share. So without further ado, here we go. Well, hey guys, it's been a hot minute since I have talked to you all. It's been busy, and with the holidays and so much going on, I feel like it's been a long time since I've hopped on and done a webinar. But I was recently, well, it seems like recently, well, it wasn't that long ago, TAGT did their Gift Ed 20 conference, and I was doing a session, well, really, it was just a conversation about PBL. And Will, my guest this evening, happened to be in that session. And he started talking, and I just wanted to be quiet and let him talk because he had so much to share. And it was such good stuff. Like we were really speaking the same language, and so much of what I believe to be true about project-based learning, it was coming out of Will's mouth, and I was like, oh my gosh, we are speaking the same language, which was very cool. So first of all, Will, I want to say thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely my pleasure, Andy. I can't wait. I'm humbled and honored that you asked to talk to me outside of the conference.
Well, I can't wait for the Meaningful Mess community to hear all that you have to share. So what we're going to be talking about tonight is project-based learning, and this is going to be on Facebook. It's also over on YouTube, and you'll also be able to hear this over at the podcast, the Meaningful Mess podcast. So we're going to just jump right in because I'm terrible at like openings and closings. So we'll just jump right in, and I'm going to open it up. And Will, if you will take just a minute to introduce yourself to the audience, tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe kind of how you got started with PBL.
Not a problem. My pleasure. Well, my name is Will Rodriguez. I teach animation, and I taught for a while digital art at Manor New Technology High School. It is a 100% project-based learning campus. I started there 7 years ago. I had about 23 years of previous experience as a graphic designer, a freelance illustrator, and a freelance animator when somewhere along the line, my family and friends said, hey, you know what? You should try teaching this. And I said, no. I'm a cartoonist. I'm an animator. I'm not a teacher. And fatherhood kind of changed that for me.
Yes. So,
I started teaching my kids how to draw on the basics and watching their faces light up. Just it became a new drug for me. And I went ahead and went back to school. I got my degree and became a teacher way back in 2014.
And forever ago.
so long ago. And when I fell into teaching, and I fell into teaching. When I fell into teaching, I was actually teaching at a regular high middle school. It's a middle school. And I was a teacher's assistant when I went ahead and applied for my full-time teaching gig. I want my own classroom. I want to teach this. And it happened to be here at Maynard New Tech. So I have a little bit of a leg up when it comes to PBL, because when I came in, I remember them saying, are you familiar with PBL? And I said, yeah, there was a whole section of it when I was getting my degree. and honestly, when I saw it implemented at this school, it just made sense. The fact that project-based learning, it automatically fits into the fine arts by default, just in its design.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers, anyone that teaches any kind of fine art is already using project-based learning, whether they realize it or not.
That's a good point.
It really is. Thank you. And the fact that other disciplines have learned that if they can tap into that creativity, if they can harness that voice within the scholar, we call students scholars on my campus. But once we tap into that creativity within the scholar, then we give them free rein to master and drive their own education, which is ultimately the goal when we're trying to create lifelong learners. And within the fine arts, because I was already, you know, I have background in cartooning and freelance illustration and animation, because I already had that, when I stepped onto this campus and I saw other disciplines saying, hey, we're going to be creating posters. Hey, we're going to be making video game designs. We're going to be making comic books and doing stuff that was already visually artistic. I said, this is perfect. This is beautiful. And I fell in love with it. And I've been there ever since. I couldn't see teaching any other way. It is 21st century education.
Yeah, it's so true. And I love that you talked about that idea of students driving their own learning. I just recently did a podcast on that I think actually may have come out today at 3:00. And so it was, I can't remember if it was last week or this week, but that whole idea, and a lot of times I talk about how when I let my students, and you can tell me if you kind of had the same experience, but when I let my students drive the learning, there were really some very specific outcomes. So I always like to say that it's an acronym for DRIVE. They were more determined. The learning was relevant, which I know you're going to talk a little bit about tonight. My students became more independent. They found value in the learning, and they were more empowered. And so really all of those words, if you're listening to this as an educator, those are kind of the words that I think we as educators kind of perk up to, like, oh, wait, if my kids could do that, if it could result in that. And I think one of the things that Will and I both want to share tonight and help you understand is that that is what comes as a result of putting your students in the driver's seat. So you talked a little bit about the impact that it had on you as an educator and how you kind of started to go that direction. You were put into a very cool situation. But I think also, Will, what were some of the impacts, or what has been some of the impact that PBL has had on your learners?
Honestly, the fact that the big common denominator that comes out of this at the end of every unit, at the end of every semester, at the end of every school year, is the fact that the kiddos get to interpret, they get to synthesize as it pertains to them. The fact that when they come out of a project, they're able to say, okay, so my final product, because people get that confused, the project versus product. But the product comes from the project. When we finished out our project and they have a product to show, it is something that came from them. It came from their creativity. It came from their core. And having that free reign, understanding that yours isn't going to look like your buddies, is not going to look like the other classmates. So everyone's going to have that, their interpretation of what that final product is going to look like. And before I go any further, let me also point out that for those of you who were just getting into PBL, one of the traps of novice PBL instruction is having a preset, predetermined view of how your final product should look. It's kind of hard to shake that off, but the sooner that you do, the more authentic, the more relevant your final product is going to be. Because when you let the kids drive and they are able to say, okay, I interpret it as blank, they've taken, by this point, by that point, at the very end, when they're actually up in front of the class, because the key to a, well, the most valuable assessment in any sort of project is that final presentation. What we do on our campus is we have our kiddos get up in front of the class. They come in full presentation attire. You are a professional in whatever it was that we were learning about, because that's, you know, driving questions, right? If you're new or you're a vet, you know a driving question is important to your project. So when they step in and you've had your driving question, you are a professional in this field. You're learning about this thing. You're fixing a real world problem, right? At that very end, when the kiddos can step up in front of the entire class, whether it be group or solitary, excuse me, they're standing up there in front of everyone and they are laying out, this is my product. This is what I learned. They got to follow the breadcrumbs to what your ultimate goal is, which is that unit that's they're learning. I feel like I ran off on a tangent, Andy. I'm sorry.
No, first of all, I do that all the time. And I don't think it was a tangent at all. I love that idea of the teacher. I don't know if this is where you're going with this, but I like the idea of the teacher almost leaving breadcrumbs. And then, you know, as I want to talk about that idea of the teacher as the facilitator. And that's almost, you know, a lot of times I think that educators with PBL feel like they lose their role. Like, well, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do or how do I help if I'm not an expert in that particular project that they're working on, or how can I support them? And so I think one of the other questions that I had before we go into that is, so you talked about when they do a presentation or when they have a product. Have you had learners or have you had situations where there wasn't a product or something didn't turn out like your students had hoped that it would? And if so, what was the result of that? Or what did that, how did that play out?
Absolutely. One of the other strengths in this method of instruction is making sure that you can help the kiddos understand and cope with the idea that you don't have to have all the answers, and you let them know up front, I don't. I may have a lot of them because I've been around here quite a bit longer than you have, but that doesn't mean I have all of them. And I'll be the first one to tell you, if I don't have the answers that we're looking for, I get to show you how I'm going to find those answers and thereby still instruct you in how you can get those answers too. Right? That's putting them in that driver's seat. That's putting them in full control, or understanding that they have that full control over their education. So when we have I teach a fine art class. Well, I teach an animation class. So obviously, we're going to have different interpretations of final products. I tell you, I would love for you to go ahead and show me what it looks like for a bouncing ball to fall down some stairs. Sure, I'm going to show you how I interpreted that. But someone may change the perspective. Someone may change what the ball is made out of. No one says it has to be a bouncy ball. It can be a bowling ball. That interpretation, the fact that not everyone is going to look the same, gives us a chance to say, okay, did they fail? No, you gave me what you understood. So all that does on the teacher end is that says, hey, either I did not convey everything I needed to convey because, you know, I came in with a preconceived notion. I said, oh, well, I see a bouncy ball bouncing downstairs. But if a kiddo can come in and show me a new way to see something that we're going into, then I've just learned something from my kids as much as they're learning from me. So I'm the first one to let them know, hey, guys, I hadn't thought of it that way. And I love that you were able to show me that. I can tell you one instance where I was teaching kids how to use Photoshop. We were using some tools in Photoshop. And one of my kiddos stepped in and said, you know, we can use the pen tool in this manner, and we can add anchors. And my brain said, and I named the method after him. I said, I'm going to call this the Tristan. This is the Tristan method, because you showed me how to do this, and I'm going to teach everyone from this day forward that I learned this from you.
And, man, that's definitely ownership. That's like literal ownership of the learning. That's what that is. That's so cool. And I think that it's such a good point that, you know, failure does not mean, I oftentimes will say that failure is a detour. It's not a dead end. And a lot of times when I was traveling, now I'm not traveling as much, but when I was traveling, I can think about so many times that I would be driving and I would have to take a detour, and I'd be frustrated because it's like, I just need to get from point A to point B, which a lot of times is how our kids see learning, right? I got to get from point A to point B. And sometimes it was on the detour that I would see the coolest things, right? It was on the detour that I would really realize, oh, that's where that is. Or I've always wondered where that was, and I would have never seen it on my original route. And so I think the same is true for our kids in PBL, is sometimes it's through that detour of struggle and failure that they see things that they wouldn't have seen originally. Does that make sense? Have you had that experience?
Absolutely. I always tell them, you know, what you call failure, I call foundation. Everything that we tried that didn't work out the way we wanted it to work out just showed us what wasn't going to work. And it gave us an opportunity to find creative ways to find that solution. And best of all, one of the things I've always loved about PBL is that collaboration, how important it is. Even if you're not working in a group, while groups are very helpful, there are times that you want to work on your own, but having an idea partner, having a whole group of people who are also working towards that same resolution, some sort of fix to problem A. Hey, you know what? If we can't get from A to B, it's all right if I got to go to A1, A2, A3, A4 before I even get to B. Obviously, you know, we've got those instances in the classroom, as you're always going to have as adults too. Like you said, I just want to get from here to there. I'm trying to find the shortest route possible. And that detour really creates an opportunity for exploration. And that's where the organic nature of project-based learning really comes into play. Because at that point, you can say, okay, well, while I wanted to have this unit wrapped up in, you know, 3 weeks, we're going to spend another week on this because you guys are making some really good points. We're finding some very valid information here that needs to be shared. And that gives you as the teacher an opportunity to really record where this thing is going and see if it repeats itself next time around.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So we talked a little, this is kind of a surprise question that I didn't send you, but I think this is a conversation that you'll be willing to have. You're about to see what I did there. But we kind of start getting into, because I want to talk to teachers who are maybe thinking about PBL, project-based learning. You've heard about it. It's something that you've thought about, considered, but it seems overwhelming or a little bit, you know, not right now. It doesn't seem like a good time. Talk a little bit. One of the things that you and I were talking about before we pushed record was just that willingness. So will you talk a little bit to that point and what it looks like to kind of grab a hold of that willingness so that you can move forward with something like PBL?
Absolutely. when it comes to stepping into anything new, it is imperative that you analyze yourself. You have to verify whether or not you're coming into this with a fixed mindset, a preconceived notion, a written in stone belief that you're unwilling to change. Because if any of those things exist, you're basically making more work for yourself. You're worrying. You're going to find yourself anxious. You're going to be contemplating what could go wrong. And all of those things are just going to make the entire process less enjoyable. Whereas if you step into this saying, you know what, I haven't done this before, but I'm willing to try it, and make sure that you make that clear to your kiddos. Hey, guys, we're going to try something out. And I'd love it if you would join me on this expedition, honestly. You let the kiddos know, hey, yeah, I'm at the front of the class. Yeah, I'm getting paid to do what I'm doing right now. But ultimately, we're still equal in some respect, because we're all going to go on this path together. together. We're going to go on this adventure together. We're going to see how this thing turns out. So if I'm not sure of something, we're going to find out how to fix it together, all of us. You know, that right there is going to be so much more advantageous just by, A, making sure that you are giving ownership of what's about to happen, co-ownership to the kiddos, makes them aware of just how important their contribution is to this entire process. And honestly, it breaks down those walls that I've had a lot of colleagues have to work through, where they step into the classroom and, well, I have to keep up that air of I'm running things and this is my kingdom, and I need to ensure that my subjects understand that I'm the leader. And unfortunately, that totalitarian stance is very limiting in itself just by nature. So we can collaborate, not just with other teachers, but with our kiddos. It makes for a two-way street. I'm going to give you all the knowledge I know, and I'm going to take whatever knowledge you bring to the table, and we're going to make something really cool out of this at the very end.
Yeah, and I think that's what ultimately results in that willingness to invest from both people involved, right? There's that willingness to invest as an educator, but it's that whole, you know, flip. I don't even know if I can do my hands that way, but, you know, it's the whole, and if you're listening to the podcast, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but it's that flip side of there has to be a willingness from the educator in order that for there to be that willingness to invest from the learner. And we use that wording, I say it all the time, but that's what engagement is. It's not passive, it's active. And it really is that willingness to invest, in that's such a big part of PBL. So can you think of a student that you've had, or maybe just somebody, an experience that you've had? I wanted you to talk about a project where maybe there hasn't been that willingness to invest, but all of a sudden there was kind of like the light bulb went off for one of your students, or maybe for a group of students who were more willing to invest because of PBL being a priority in your classroom.
Ooh.
That's a tough one.
It is. And as I roll through my Rolodex of just 7 years.
Yeah.
I can remember when we were making a cookbook in one of my graphic design classes. When the process that we follow, I know PBL is not as linear as some people may think. It is very organic. It uses a design function to it, where you have to revisit some steps that you may have done earlier. And when we were creating this cookbook, I remember that I put together the rubric, because that's imperative, having that rubric, because in 100% PBL school, the scholars understand very quickly, if it's not on the rubric, technically you can't grade me for that. And we've caught each other on it. Regardless, we're making this cookbook, and as we're going through, I realized that I had mentioned that we were going to be designing a lot of the aspects. It's a graphic design class, so it's a lot of layout, and there was some graphical objects that kiddos are going to be creating in a vector program, Adobe Illustrator. And I had some kiddos come to me and say, hey, Mr. Rodriguez, instead of basically crafting all of these images, I mean, it's a cookbook, so shouldn't it have photographs of, you know, the pieces, the final products that we've made when we created our recipes? And I was like, yeah, well, you could just, you know, you can draw the plate, you can create the shapes that of the food. And it's like, yeah, but isn't photography also an art form? And I had to step back and say, you know, yeah, it is. So they asked if they could bring that in. And I said, okay, well, then that means that we're going to have to revisit the rubric, because if we want to make this part of this project, then I'm going to need your help. And the kiddos who were very, very reluctant to even partake in this project because, A, they didn't know how to cook, or, B, Adobe Illustrator can be a beast of a program to learn. But as soon as they realized that they could take pictures, and the fact that we were revisiting an earlier step, which was the rubric, that's you launch a project, that's one of the first things that you lay down. Here's the rubric. This is how I'm going to be grading what I'm going to be seeing from you guys. And they had a hand in constructing that rubric. Suddenly, the cookbook was a huge success by the last, and this was a five-week unit. We were in the, I want to say, third or fourth week when this came out, and I said, let's revisit the rubric. And we went back, and the kiddos plugged in their thoughts. They included photography as one of the aspects to be graded in creativity, how the photographs were supposed to look, angles, shots, lighting. They went to town. So that the final cookbook, again, I had come in. This was probably my third year of teaching. I had come in with a preconceived notion. I said, they're going to create all of the artwork. It's going to look like vector art. It's going to be clean. It's going to be pretty. It ended up being a cookbook that was predominantly just photographs with some little graphic elements around the recipes that was beautiful. And I was able to tell the guys, hey, you know what? This was fun. And they were all the same. Are you going to do this every year, Mr. Rodriguez? And I yeah. And then the next year, they took graphic design off my plate and I wasn't teaching graphic design.
Oh, of course. Of course. That story speaks to so much of what we've talked about. That whole, well, first of all, willingness to be flexible on your part, right? Not saying, you know, this is what the rubric says, this is what we're doing. But just being flexible enough to say, you know what, that's not a bad idea. And that gives them ownership, which puts them in the driver's seat. And now all of a sudden, they're determined to show you that they can do it this way. It's relevant. They're more independent. They found value in it. And then ultimately they're empowered, which I think is so cool. So that story is perfect because it kind of wraps all of those pieces together. Going back to somebody who is just kind of thinking about making PBL a priority, what would you say are some of the first steps that they can begin to take to kind of move in this direction? I know you teach within a campus that is driven through project-based learning, but let's say that a teacher is not on a campus like that. They just kind of, it just has kind of tapped into their curiosity. They're wondering what this might look like. How can they start moving in this direction?
I think one of the first things that they're going to want to do is make it relevant. How you want to answer the why question before your scholars even have an opportunity to ask it. You're going to make sure that whatever you're going to be teaching them, before the kiddo can say, when am I ever going to use this? You've already got that answer. That is your get-go. That is within the first stages of creating your project. Is what question am I going to answer before they even ask it? Why is this relevant? Where are they going to see this in use outside of the classroom, right? So that when they step into that project, regardless of how much experience they have, they are now professionals in that arena. So if you've got a question about creating a space station that can sustain, you know, humans in deep space, then before the kiddos step into that role, you are letting them know, hey, you are now an engineer. You are now a designer. You are now a technician whose sole job it is to keep 25 human beings alive in deep space. This is a real problem that professionals are trying to solve, and you now get to take part in that. Once you know what question you're going to answer, directly after that is going to come out, well, me and a couple of friends have some disagreement here. I've got some friends who say the next thing you need is your entry event. You have to have your hook, just like a really good comic or an incredible movie, something that grabs a hold of the kiddo's attention and pulls them in. And that entry event can be a video, it can be a flyer, it could be a handout. Those are kind of the boring ones. Then there's the fun one when you actually get a hold of somebody in the field that these kiddos are stepping into to come into the classroom. I had a colleague who actually had one of the an English professor, ancient literature professor, get into ancient Roman costume, step into the classroom, and started listing out the problems he was having in his kingdom.
Oh my gosh, I love that. That's and a hot right there.
It was awesome because the kiddos from all other classes, the school that I work in has really big windows. So when they saw this guy coming in full Roman attire, he's got the laurel around his head and the sandals, and he comes walking in carrying a cat of nine tails, and he's looking for a specific person, which was the teacher herself. And everyone was at the window, faces pressed up against the glass, amazed to see this guy walk into the classroom, throw the door open, asking why no one was there to let him in. He was in full character. And it was an amazing experience for those kiddos because they didn't know him. They didn't know he was a college professor. He got into it. He came out. He pitched it. And it was awesome. But for me, besides the entry event, for me, I like to build the rubric next.
Okay.
Because if I know what relevance I'm trying to tie in here, then I need to make sure that I'm clear for myself.
Mm-hmm.
What am I grading and how am I grading it? Am I grading more than one learning outcome? We have learning outcomes on my campus. So all the teachers have an obvious focus for their discipline, but we all spend some time talking about oral communication, how you present yourself, written communication, the ability to write academically, collaboration, agency. All these things are things that we grade, school-wide learning outcomes that we grade on campus.
Mm-hmm.
For me, as long as I know, okay, am I just grading one facet or am I grading two facets on this? Is this a big enough project that I can do that? I want to know how I'm going to grade that. So my rubric comes together, and because I'm already an artist, my rubric is always color-coded. I'm a big nerd about that. And I make sure that I'm setting up my columns so that I have my emerging learners, my proficient learners, and my advanced learners. And that in and of itself, in the last 3 years, I finally put it all together in my head, is also a way to differentiate my class. The fact that I already know, I work in my rubrics, I don't work punitively. It becomes a growth so that I tell the kiddos, I don't tell the kiddos, I'm taking points off, or I always tell them, you're starting off with nothing because you haven't done anything yet. Everything that you do adds to that. So my rubric starts off with, here we are in the emerging column, and you're going to turn in a video. Hey, you just got 10% of your grade right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then next thing, the video has some drawing elements to it. Hey, there's 20%. So we just add on to that so that the first column, while I may have 10 points across all three columns, I know that my first column, I'm going to bring all 10 points into that first column for my emerging learners, my kiddos that are going to be kind of my low flyers, those who have maybe confidence issues. And then my next column is going to say, I'm going to take all of this from the first column and I'm going to add in the second column. This is for all my, you know, middle of the road kiddos, all the guys who signed up for animation, kind of knew what they were getting into, but didn't know it was going to be this much work.
Right.
And then my advanced column is all of it. It's the whole shebang. And these are the kiddos who take what they've learned and can apply it to other disciplines. If they can take what they pick up from here and show me that they can synthesize this in other classes, in other situations, you're my advanced animator. You have shown me that, you know, what I tell them is, if you can make my chin touch my chest, then this right here is where you belong. You know, that amazement. Wow me. But those are the early steps for most projects. Making that relevance, how is it going to be functional? Making either your rubric or your entry event, and then the other, whichever you choose. And, of course, having that session at the very beginning of a project of having the kids tell you, what do you know about this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you need to know to make this thing? And that becomes a living document. I make mine inside of a discussion thread so that the kiddos, we revisit that at least twice during a presentation, during a project.
Mm-hmm.
So that we make the knows and need to knows. I know if we're making an animated short. I know what the pre-production stages are. I need to know what is included in the post-production sequence. Well, now I know what I'm teaching for this whole thing. That right there is a gold mine of information.
Mm-hmm.
I've got my nose and need to knows. I can now plan out the next couple of weeks, but here's the thing. Because that's a living document, when we return to it in about a week or two, and I ask the kiddos, let's revisit those knows and need to knows. Tell me where we stand. Johnny, I see that you said you needed to know the post-production sequence. Where are we in that? And Johnny's going to come back and say, well, now I know all the sequences. Awesome. Can we move that over here to the knows column? And new questions? Do we have any new nuggets of information that need to be found? Can we spread out those breadcrumbs a little bit?
Yeah.
And they come asking those questions. That curiosity is tapped. And then the project is rolling.
Yeah, I love those steps to starting a project. And it really is, it's like a roadmap, right? And I think every teacher has their own roadmap. I always like to say it's never a checklist. I'm not a fan of checklists. But it really is, it's like the 6 P's of Genius Hour and your steps of an entry event and a rubric and then an entry event. But it is a roadmap. These are the places we need to make sure that we stop. But that can look different for every educator and can depending on your class. And so I think part of it, and tell me if you kind of agree with this, I think part of it has to be a mindset shift first for an educator to begin to see themselves as a designer versus just a lesson planner. I talk about that all the time, you know, shifting from just writing lesson plans to designing experiences. But we have to start to see ourselves differently. And you mentioned a word earlier that I'm such a fan of right now. I'm kind of obsessed with it. But I think in where we are right now in education, with what we've been through and where we're headed, you know, we have that opportunity to see this as a challenge or to see it as an adventure, which is what you called it earlier. And I love that. I'm actually going to link in the comments, I'll put a link later. There's a great blog post about the adventure mindset. And it's not related to education, but I was reading it recently and I thought, gosh, if we could, as educators, take some of those ideas that are woven into an adventure mindset and use it moving forward and understand this is a challenge, but it's also an adventure, I think that could help with people getting to this mindset that they need in order to make PBL a reality. Would you agree? What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Just the idea that you cannot have a meaningful adventure without the challenge. Mm. Otherwise, you've got to, in writing, it's called the Mary Sue. You've got a Mary Sue effect where, you know, everything that needs to happen just happens. And hey, that was so easy. And that gets dull. That gets boring. One of the cool things about being a project designer is the fact that as professions evolve, as the world actually moves forward, everything that was relevant won't always be. I sat through a talk once where a professor from Texas A&M said, figure out how old the kiddos in your class are going to, what year it will be when your kiddos are in their 30s.
Oh, gosh.
And if you can do that little bit of math, it's not going to hurt you. do that little bit of math that says, okay, it will be the year 20 blah, 20 whatever, that my kiddos will be in their 30s. You need to teach them with that year in mind.
Mm.
Right? So that, okay, I'm teaching you how I've done things, and that's great for a foundation. But you're going to do things that I may never have a chance to try. So let me at least keep your mind open so that you know where to start this adventure of yours and where you're going to take it. And do me a favor and drop me a line and let me know how it goes, because I'm interested. I mean, obviously, any forgive me for sounding conceited, any good teacher wants to know how to go.
Mm-hmm.
How did it turn out? What was your outcome? You know, where are you right now? I mean, that is what made me make it past that 5-year mark. I think, you know, that 5-year magic number for most teachers.
Yes.
that what got me past that hump of, wow, am I doing the right thing? And am I really making a difference? Do these kids even care about Adobe products? And it was when one of my graduates came back and she told me she was working in an engineering firm, and she smiled and she says, "Mr. Rodriguez, you know, I'm still using layers." And I just,
oh my God,
what? And she said, "I've never seen myself as an artist, but when you tell us on the very first day that you didn't care if we were a level 1 or a level 99 artist, that really spoke to me." And she says, "I may have graduated 3 years ago." This was at that time. This was about 2.5 years ago. She says, "I may have graduated 3 years ago, but I still see myself at least as an artist. I may be a level 3, but I'm still an artist." And I came home and I cried to my wife and I was like, "I'm making a difference. Some of them care."
It's so funny because they do. They remember so much more than we think they do. And they, you know, I run into students now, first of all, who are adults. And I'm like, you cannot be that old. That can't be happening. But it's true. And they remember things that it's like, that's what you remember. Like, but it's just those small things or those connections that they make that have an impact on them. Okay, so as we kind of start to wrap up, I know that one of the questions I get most often, and probably something that you guys on your campus, being a PBL campus, have to often address. One of the things that I've said a lot lately is just that things moving forward, they probably should have been this before, but moving forward, they have to be so much more of this, and that is manageable for the educator and meaningful for the learners. And we've talked a lot about how PBL is meaningful for the learners, but if you could give one piece of advice to make PBL manageable, right? How do I manage this so that it doesn't seem so overwhelming and so big during an already difficult time? What would that piece of advice be?
Start off small for yourself. Make it relevant to you at first. Make it count. Make it something that you want to explore. Make sure that it's something that you don't know everything about. That way, the authentic nature of learning is taking place for you as the head of the class and for your kiddos. And don't expect to do PBL all year out the gate. Take one unit, just one unit that you would like to work on this year or whatever year that you're in. Say, I definitely want to know more about X. And I know I don't know everything. So why don't I make this the project? Why don't I make the project around this? So it's just one unit out of all your classes you've already got planned out. That one thing that you say, I've always wanted to touch on this, but I don't know enough about it. This way, as you start to construct or design your project, you don't know what it's going to look like, or at least you shouldn't at the end. As the kiddos come in and you say at the very onset, "Hey guys, we're gonna start XYZ," or you go with that entry event, right? I knew a chemistry teacher who loved to show his class appropriate YouTube videos, stuff that he found funny. He would start off class with a YouTube video. Maybe he'd have the kiddos write about it. Maybe it was just something he found offhandedly funny. But also, he would use those to launch projects. He'd launch the beginning of a zombie video that was talking about chemical bio. I don't know what. I'm sorry. I'm not the greatest. I'm not a science teacher.
I can't be out there either.
But he started it off showing them a clip from a zombie movie, and the kids got all excited. And then when he paused it and turned to them and said, "Now imagine," and there it was. There was that launch. That was the relevance. It was. I think it was a pandemic setup. He was talking about a pandemic, right?
But yeah, a little bit,
or I should say, poetic. Anyway, he did this kind of thing, and that's what you can say to yourself. Well, you know what? Whatever that entry event is, make that hook. So the kids go, "Yeah, that is kind of interesting," and then let them know, "Hey, we're going to try something new. I'm going to try it with you. We're all going to learn something together out of this. And I want you to know that I'm going to learn from you just as much as you learn from me, and we're going to grow in this together. Give them the reins. Give them the key. Let them know that, hey, I'm not some omnipotent grade god handing down from on high. I'm a human being who wants to know more about this. Mm-hmm. Great thing about when I stepped into teaching, someone said, yeah, it's kind of cool when you can just count on it, when you can just depend on it, when you know that, hey, you know what? I taught this last year. I'm going to teach it this year. I'm going to teach it next year. I said, wow, that just sounds kind of boring to me. Mm-hmm. And I stepped into project-based learning, and they said, the cool thing about this is that because it's always growing in relevance, because it's always changing, because it's always evolving, you don't have to worry about teaching something usually more than about twice before mm-hmm. something new comes out and you realize, oh, well, hey, I want to know more about that. Let's turn that into a project.
Mm-hmm. Man, so good. Just putting them in the driver's seat. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? Is giving them some of that ownership. I feel like if we had to have a theme for this conversation, that's what it would be. Okay, this really is the last question. I keep saying I have one more. But we are in this situation now where we have in-class and ed-hump learners. So any advice for how you guys are doing it, because you are a PBL campus, do you have remote learners or do you have kids who are doing PBL at home? What has that looked like for you guys?
There is remote learning happening right now. I think across the nation, there has been a relative shift in all of our kiddos. I know the vast majority of my, you know, middle of the road kiddos have dropped to barely making it. And my high flyers are now maybe around the middle of the road. It's been a shift across the nation. We've seen it happen. As stressed out as we are, our kiddos who haven't been giving those coping mechanisms are even more in distress. So what we've had to do is step back and reevaluate how many of our colleagues are the showboats. How many of your colleagues are the people that step out and say, well, look at my classroom and look what I'm teaching and look what my kids are learning and look how rigorous. People seem to confuse rigor with difficulty or workload. And they don't seem to realize that rigor just means making a kid think. You can make a kid, help a kid think without weighing them down with tons of work because we're making more work for ourselves. So we had to step back as a campus and reevaluate how many of us are showboating? How many of us are actually actively trying to help our kiddos grasp the subjects that we teach? And I think that in trying to get back to the norm, we make more work for them and more stress for them and more work and stress for ourselves. So project-based learning, while the stages haven't really changed, it's the delivery, the end products that have had to shift, that have had to evolve with where we are. So while the end product may not be as elaborate or as showboaty as it has been in the past, can I still help you understand this little nugget of information that I'm trying to teach? If I can help you get here with, you know, something simple, then let's go that route, because I don't want you to feel like you're falling even more behind than what you probably already feel. Mm-hmm. So it's been simplifying, streamlining, and ensuring that there are lots of check-ins. Social-emotional learning is more important now than it ever has been. And honestly, opening up a class, instead of with a warm-up to get things rolling, it's usually more of a check-in, at least in my class and at least mm-hmm. my colleagues. It's a, hey, scale of 1 to 5. Give me a little rundown. Give me a temperature check here in the chat. Just kind of throw in there, you know, 1, I'm so chill that Snoopy was my first name, or 5, I'm pulling my hair out, Mr. Rodriguez, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I look for anyone that's a 3 or higher, and I remember to check in with them before we get out of class and pull them aside and say, hey, can you hang out for a minute? Everyone else, we finished off. You guys have a great day. Johnny, I need you to hang out for me just for a second.
I like that idea of a scale.
That way I can tell Johnny, hey, I saw that you put a 3.5 inside of the chat, man. You want to, can you help me help you? Just where are you? Is it homebound? Is it school? And most of the time it's, I got so much stuff to do, Mr. Rodriguez. And I'll be the first one to say, okay, well, you know, all of your teachers are my colleagues. Mm-hmm. It can help you out a little bit. It's better if you let them know. You know, you teach a kid to advocate for themselves, but then in the meantime, I'm still going to go to some of my colleagues and say, hey, I don't know if you know this, but Johnny's having a really hard time. Well, yeah, he's not turning anything in. Well, that's because Johnny feels like he's falling so behind that there's no point. So that check-in has become a regular thing for me, that temperature check, that check-in with the kiddos and letting them know that I'm not just, you know, the animation teacher, but, you know, I care about where you are. I care about how you're dealing with stuff. You know, if your grandma's sick, then, you know, maybe you just need somebody to talk to. Maybe mom and dad are so busy taking care of grandma who's sick that no one knows what you have to say. So talk to me.
Yeah. And it's humbling, right, as a teacher to be in this place of it really has kind of leveled the playing field. And we're having to rethink so much of what we thought we knew and we thought was going so well. And I think those are all such great points of really getting to know them on a personal level and caring enough that they know you care about the project they're working on, but you care more about them. That's good stuff. So as we kind of wrap up, I just, one more thing that I want to make sure that I share is that Will talked a lot about starting small and taking baby steps. And when we were actually in that meeting together and talking about PBL together, one of the participants actually brought up this idea of PBL baby steps. And she was wanting to give something to her teachers as far as baby steps go. And so I'm going to put a link in the chat. I just didn't want to forget to share this. If you're wanting to just start small and kind of start to cultivate that PBL mindset in your classroom with in-class or at-home learners or on your campus or your district, if you're an administrator, I'm going to put a link to some of those baby steps that you can check out. So definitely go check that blog post out. And there's actually a graphic that you can use with your staff or with your classroom. But I love that Will brought that up because it's such, you know, I think some of the themes throughout this evening's conversation has been, first of all, you have to shift your mindset. Right. You have to be in a place to where you want to prioritize it. There has to be that willingness, as Will said. I think also the baby steps, you know, starting small and then having a plan, but having a manageable plan, not trying to go all in, especially right now because your plates are so full as educators. So Will, as we kind of wrap up, do you have any kind of final pieces of advice that you would offer or anything you want to say in closing?
Sure. Anyone who's putting their toes into the PBL waters as it
you make it sound so tempting, so fun.
as you're dipping your toes into that sauna of PBL, keep in mind that nobody masters PBL out of the gate.
So true.
Most of the folks that on my campus, it took on average about 3 or 4 years before they were at least comfortable in designing projects and seeing themselves as project designers. So if you don't get it in the first week, it's okay. If you don't get it in the first month, it's all right. If you don't get it in the first 2 to 3 years, you're not alone. There are resources out there to help you out. Utilize the links that Andy's putting in the chat and don't be afraid to take control of your education. Mm-hmm. Reach out there and find the already laid out roadmap from other folks and see how you can customize it to fit what you're teaching. And above all, make sure that you have fun. Because if you're not having fun, no one else will in the classroom either.
Oh, so true. I could not have said it better myself. So the last thing I want to make sure that I say to you guys, if you're watching or if you're listening on the podcast, Will has shared some of his knowledge this evening, but he has so much more. We're just limited on time. And so I just want to say that I learned so much from him and am continuing to learn from him. You definitely want to follow him on Twitter. If you're watching, I'm actually going to put his Twitter handle. I hope that I spelled it correctly. Is that spelled correctly? If not, yep. Okay, perfect. Yep. So if you're watching, his Twitter handle is there. Why don't you share real quickly how they can connect with you on Twitter for those that are listening to the podcast. And Will, if you don't, I'm just going to say this for you. If you're wanting to dive into PBL, he is a great resource of somebody who is doing it, right? He's boots on the ground, making it happen. And I think sometimes it just helps us as educators. I know for me, when I started PBL, that person was Don Wetrick, one of the people who saved my educational career for sure. But it required me to reach out to somebody who was doing it and who could say, Andy, here's the steps. Here's where it's going to be hard. And so I think that Will would be a great person for you to reach out to and ask questions and just collaborate with. I think he's probably open to that. I'm just saying that out loud. Okay, so tell them really quickly how to connect with you on Twitter.
Once you get on Twitter, you're going to, if you want to access me at Rodriguez Sensei, I call myself Sensei because my classroom is the digital dojo. If you want to just jump on there, say, hey, I heard you or I saw you on Andy's podcast and I'm new to PBL, I've got a couple of questions. Be patient with me because at the moment I'm juggling 5 preps and 2 clubs after school. So
my goodness.
I'm passionate about creativity. One of my driving forces when I got into education was, if you haven't heard of him, Sir Ken Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
Love his stance. It became my theme for the entirety of my career so far. But jump on and just say, hey, this is where I am in my process, or this is where I'm trying to get started, or this is the unit I'm trying to teach. I can give you the creative facet, and I'll be glad to tell you a little bit about my processes. Just give me about 24 to 48 hours to get back to you. But just jump up there and just let me know who you are. Let me know what you're trying to do, what subject you're teaching, and we'll go from there.
Awesome. Well, Will, thank you so much. I know that the Meaningful Mess community has learned so much from you. I've learned so much from you, and I hope that we can continue to stay connected and continue to learn together because I say it all the time, but actually Joy Kerr, who's a friend of mine, she says it all the time. We really are better together. And so thank you for the work that you're doing in the classroom and beyond. And thanks for joining us tonight for sure.
I appreciate what you're doing with this, Andy, and helping folks understand that we are absolutely all one community. So thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful and blessed evening. And you guys out there, keep fighting the good fight and know that you're not fighting alone. We love you.
It's good stuff. All right. See you later, guys. I'm going to end the broadcast. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to learn with me today. I absolutely love this community and enjoy sharing and learning with you. Check out today's episode notes by swiping up in most podcast apps. If you'd like to learn and connect more, you can follow me over on Twitter at McNairAN3, and you can find me on Instagram and Facebook at A Meaningful Mess. You can always find tons of resources, inspiration, and information over on my website, andymcnair.com. Be sure to check out my blog, Genius Hour resources, and so much more. Enjoy the rest of your day, and as always, I hope that today's episode has inspired you to find meaning in your mess.